We're spending the hour on the impeachment inquiry, how the process happens, how it works, what it means. We're slowing it down, getting context here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Yesterday, President Trump questioned whether the chair of the House Intelligence Committee should be arrested for treason for his description of a phone call President Trump had with the president of Ukraine. And it is one of the latest developments since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said one week ago.
Today, I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry.
What do you want to know about this process? What do you need to better understand, better follow what is happening on Capitol Hill? How do you remember past impeachment investigations? Do you trust the process? Join in 800-642-1234 throughout the hour. Alan Lichtman is a distinguished professor of history at American University. He wrote the 2017 book called The Case for Impeachment, which focused on President Trump. Alan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Happy to be speaking with you.
Well, help us lay out the process here. We've heard the word impeachment often enough to make quite a few assumptions, but explain to us what impeachment is not. What isn't it?
Yes, impeachment is not the cancellation of an election. That myth is even perpetrated by supporters of the impeachment of Donald Trump. Rather, the framers of our Constitution put in two equal but separate and distinct mechanisms for deciding who should be president of the United States. And both are determined by the people, but indirectly. The first mechanism is election, which is not direct election by the people, but election by a separate body called the Electoral College. And the Constitution does not require that electors in the states be chosen by popular vote. In fact, in the early Republic, the majority of states chose electors by vote of the state legislature. The second mechanism is impeachment. And impeachment is also indirectly decided by the American people. It's not a legal process. The framers advisedly put impeachment into the Constitution, not in the judiciary, but in the people's house, the House of Representatives. It decides whether or not to impeach a president by majority vote. Then articles of impeachment go over to the U.S. Senate. The U.S. Senate conducts a trial, and after the trial can remove and convict a president by a two-thirds vote. Moreover, articles of impeachment do not require the commission of a statutory crime. Alexander Hamilton, the great expositor of the Constitution, was very clear in saying that impeachment arises from an abuse of power that harms the society as a whole. In fact, statutory crimes change all the time. Most of the federal crimes on the books today didn't even exist at the time of the early Republic.
Well, the first president ever impeached was Andrew Johnson back in the 1860s, much closer to the founding of the system that you're talking about. Did that work as planned, as the founders had constructed it?
It worked exactly as planned, as the founders had constructed it. Andrew Johnson was not impeached for criminal acts. He was impeached for violating a civil statute, the Tenure of Office Act, which limited his ability to fire cabinet members. And ironically, and with much relevance to the current situation, was impeached for demeaning and attacking the Congress of the United States, a co-equal branch of government. According to the Constitution, the articles of impeachment went over to the Senate. The Senate quite properly conducted a thorough trial, and then by one vote acquitted Andrew Johnson, did not find him guilty. And in contrast to the notion that impeachment is this catastrophic event, rather the founders put impeachment into the Constitution as a legal, orderly, and peaceful process for dealing with a rogue president that was an alternative to assassination or revolution, the remedies of their time. And there was all this talk. This was just just 3 years after the end of the Civil War, there was all this talk that the impeachment of Andrew Johnson would reignite the Civil War, again, with relevance to the current controversy, and nothing of the kind occurred. In fact, although he was acquitted, Andrew Johnson was a chastised president and moderated his severe opposition to integrating newly freed slaves into American life, which was really an underlying motive for his impeachment. But worked exactly as the framers envisioned it and was good, not bad for the country.
We're looking at the impeachment inquiry, understanding our system of government, the help of history. We have Alan Lichtman here. He's a distinguished professor of history at American University. What do you want to know about this process? Do you trust the impeachment process? Is it essential to preserve our government's integrity? Maybe you think there isn't a place for it in contemporary federal government. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Alan, some critics of the president are worried Republicans won't take their concerns seriously. They're concerned that Republicans are talking about a deep state. And some of the president's supporters say they're right because they say impeachment is a partisan process at its core. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there is some truth to that. Impeachment, I wouldn't call it a partisan process, but it's a political process, and that's quite right and proper. That's what the founders envisioned when they put impeachment into elected bodies rather than the judiciary. They expected impeachment to be a combined legal, moral, and political process. And I have to say, though, in terms of the defenders of Donald Trump, if you watch the hearing of the acting director of national intelligence, Republicans were by no means as energized or as aggressive as they had been in hearings centered on the Mueller investigation. They were very subdued because even Republicans realized there were some very serious allegations against the president that not only involve abuse of power, but actually involve real statutory crimes, including violation of the campaign finance law, which says you can't take anything of value from a foreign national, possibly conspiracy against the United States, witness tampering, obstruction of justice. And my message to all of those who say impeachment is futile because a Republican Senate would never convict, you have no idea what the Senate might do when all the facts are laid on the table. Moreover, just like the trial of Andrew Johnson, the trial itself can have a salutary effect on our political system, perhaps moderating Donald J. Trump's abuses of power.
So now that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced an official inquiry, it's been a week. What are lawmakers doing? Of course, there is this recess, but do they break up into committees? What happens in the House?
Well, usually, and there's really no usually here because there's so few precedents, but ultimately, it would be the House Judiciary Committee, chaired by Representative Jerry Nadler of New York, who, by the way, was my high school debate partner at Stuyvesant High School in New York in the 1960s. So the Judiciary Committee would decide, as they did in the case of Richard Nixon, whether to recommend articles of impeachment to the full House. The full House would then vote on those articles and could adopt them and send them to the Senate by simple majority. But in the meantime, there are going to be several different committees investigating, centered on Adam Schiff's Intelligence Committee, and then they will funnel their information to the Judiciary Committee to consider whether or not to recommend one or more articles of impeachment.
Pausing right there with American University history professor Alan Lichtman as our guide. You can join in. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the impeachment process and the historical context of these investigations, what the founders of our country envisioned. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. During the past week, we've seen House Democrats pushing for quick action on their investigation into a phone transcript investigation into this whistleblower complaint. If the House approves articles of impeachment not introduced at this point, they would be sent to the Senate for trial. And yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell suggested he does not have the votes to change the rules. What do you wonder about this process? Is it essential to preserve our government's integrity? Maybe you think there's no place for it in our government. Bring your insights, bring your questions, 800-642-1234. And Alan Lichtman is our guide. He's a distinguished history professor at American University. Let's bring in Bob now, joining us from Claybanks. Bob, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for having this show. I was just curious as to, I believe in 1974, both houses were, or both branches were under Democratic control. I was curious as to how many Republicans voted for the impeachment in the House that year, and if the professor would have any insight on the, well, just on the progression of how the Republicans started coming around to that idea.
Bob, thanks so much. You were breaking up a little bit there, but Bob, taking
us... I got it.
Okay, all right, go ahead, Alan.
Yes. The full House never voted on articles of impeachment because Richard Nixon resigned. And it wasn't Democrats who drove him out of the White House. It was Republicans, former Republican presidential candidate Barry Goldwater, Republican Senate leader Hugh Scott, and other leading Republicans went to Nixon and said, look, you're going to be impeached and you're likely going to be convicted. Ever the pragmatist, Richard Nixon did not want that on his legacy, and he resigned. There were three articles of impeachment recommended by the House Judiciary Committee that were foreclosed by his resignation, and about one third of Republicans in the Judiciary Committee voted for at least one of those three articles. And by the way, two of the three articles did not reference a statutory crime. One was for abuse of power. The other was for contempt of Congress. And by the way, very much relevant to the present situation, Republicans at first were not at all on board on the idea of impeaching Richard Nixon. It was only after a lot of the evidence of his misdeeds came out that quite a few Republicans came on board, as witnessed by the Judiciary Committee vote.
Yeah, and certainly Republicans, they came out when they heard the Watergate tapes, where we heard the president himself on those tapes. Do you think this, as we draw a parallel, perhaps not, to present day, the whistleblower report is a turning point with Republicans and the president?
Yeah, I've got to make a small correction. And this is one of the biggest myths of Watergate, that it was the release of the smoking gun tape in early August that turned things. Not so. It was the testimony of over a year of investigation that turned the public and turned the Republicans. The House Judiciary Committee voted before the smoking gun tape came out. And before the smoking gun tape came out, Richard Nixon's approval rating had plummeted from 67% to 24%. Support for impeachment had risen from 19% to over 50%. That's how important public testimony can be here. And I think while certainly the transcript of that incredible conversation with President Zelensky of the Ukraine could be a turning point, we're only a week into the investigation. You know, the investigation of Richard Nixon went on for well over a year. And remarkably, 55% of the American people, and this was taken several days ago, approve of the impeachment inquiry. And even more remarkably, 47% believe that Trump should be impeached and removed from office. It took almost a year of investigation before you approach those kinds of numbers for Richard Nixon.
Let's bring in Mike now in Bear Valley. Hi, Mike.
Hello. A quick question. I'm concerned about the threatening tone of Trump's comments directed towards Schiff, Adam Schiff, Congressman, and the whistleblower. Couldn't this type of intimidation of a witness also be considered an article of impeachment? Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Got it. I agree with you, Mike. And, you know, the threats and the belligerence coming out of Donald Trump's own mouth or maybe his Twitter feed are far worse than anything that Richard Nixon said far worse during the entire protracted Watergate investigation. And I do think Mike is right that these constitute at least a prima facie case for witness tampering and obstruction of justice, especially when combined with the 10 acts of obstruction of justice found in the Mueller report. There's a pretty compelling case for witness tampering and obstruction of justice as a separate article of impeachment. There could be, you know, as many as four or five articles of impeachment coming out of just what we know so far. And we've just seen the tip of the iceberg. Look, remember, the White House also deep-sixed conversations with the Saudi royal family and with Vladimir Putin. There could be much worse, much more damning things in those conversations than even in the conversation with the Ukrainian president, which apparently they thought put the White House and the president in the best possible light. Who knows what lurks in those other conversations?
Talking with American University Distinguished History Professor Alan Lichtman. He's our guide as we discuss the impeachment inquiry this hour, the constitutional framework around it, with your questions, your insights, as well at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about past impeachment investigations? What stands out to you about the situation when President Clinton was impeached? What do you recall from President Nixon's era? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's look at this phone call and the memo that was recapping President Trump's conversation with the Ukrainian president. The president saying no quid pro quo here, that he didn't pressure the president of Ukraine for an exchange here, that this was a normal phone call. How do we consider those statements and alongside the information we have about this phone call?
It's not normal. It's not a perfect conversation as the president has misportrayed it. In fact, his staunchest defenders don't even appear to know what's in that conversation. Kevin McCarthy, his chief defender, the Republican leader of the House, was surprised on national television when the interviewer pointed out that the word though, very critical, was at the end of "Will you do me a favor, though?" McCarthy didn't even seem to know it and thought the interviewer was putting words into the transcript. Look, Michael Cohen, who had been Trump's lawyers for 10 years, made it very clear. Trump doesn't speak directly ABC. He speaks in code. But in this case, the code is so apparent that a middle schooler could decipher it. You know, it does sound like a mafia boss. I could hear, you know, the echoes of Don Corleone of the famous Godfather movies. You know, the United States has been very, very good to you, but you know, there hasn't been enough reciprocity. So I want you to do me this little favor, though. You know, it's an offer that the Ukrainian president could not refuse. Ukraine is totally dependent on the United States. And it's patently obvious. Trump was extorting him by playing on that dependence. And Zelensky even explicitly recognized it when he talked about the need for aid to the U.S. and his need to buy those Javelin missiles. And by the way, without apparently consulting any of the proper officials, without informing Congress, shortly before that call, Trump had suspended the critical lifeblood aid to Ukraine.
Paul from Eau Claire emailed to ask, how would you respond, Alan Lichtman, to a critic of impeachment who says impeachment is just the latest anti-Trump move, like Russian collusion, like Robert Mueller subpoenas, like Stormy Daniels? This is one in a line of things that are just lining up against the president here.
Well, I think that's right, but you can't blame the investigators for what's lining up against the president. It was the president who paid hush money to Stormy Daniels and to Karen McDougal, women who had alleged affairs with him and then tried illegally to conceal it as a business expense. Michael Cohen is sitting in prison in part for those campaign finance laws violations, which are felonies, and the Southern District of New York has proven they were directed by Donald Trump. We have conversations. We have the checks. And it was Donald Trump who obstructed justice, not Robert Mueller and his report. And while Mueller did not find a criminal conspiracy, he didn't absolve Trump of that. He simply said there wasn't evidence to prove it. And that was in part because of the obstruction of justice. And again, it was Donald Trump in his conversation with Zelensky that abused his power and I believe violated the campaign finance laws. So it's not the messenger that's responsible for this. It's Donald Trump himself.
Talking with American University history professor Alan Lichtman, how do you remember past impeachment investigations? What stands out to you about the current situation and past impeachments like with President Clinton? What do you remember from Nixon's era? Join in at 800-642-1234 throughout the hour. We'll continue this conversation with Alan Lichtman after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the impeachment inquiry into President Trump here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a process that's set to take months. We are going inside the process to understand how it works and the purpose of the congressional investigation. Yesterday, we saw House Democrats, they subpoenaed the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, in their inquiry. And then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said a Senate trial would be unavoidable if the House impeached President Trump. So what questions do you have that are weighing on your mind as we see this play out on Capitol Hill? What do you need to understand to better follow what's happening? Be part of this discussion, 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. And American University history professor Alan Lichtman stays with us. He wrote the 2017 book, The Case for Impeachment. Let's go back to the phones now. Effie is joining us from Heartland. Hi, Effie.
Hi there.
Hi.
My question goes to a different area of whether or not the impeachment process works, I guess. I'm concerned about incompetence within the presidency. Is there anything that addresses incompetence or mental defect or mental derangement? I'm thinking more about when President Wilson was unable to act as a president and his wife and others kind of like hid the whole thing. But as a healthcare professional, I am really concerned about President Trump's actions and his behavior.
Let's pause right here and have Alan respond on competence, because this could also be a very subjective gray area, Alan.
Yeah. Well, in fact, there is a separate mechanism that most people are not familiar with for dealing with a president who is unable for reasons of physical or psychological issues to carry out the duties of the presidency. It's the 25th Amendment to the Constitution, passed in the 1960s, and it's a very difficult mechanism. You have to have a majority of the cabinet certifying that the president is unable to carry out his duties. The president has a right to respond, and then ultimately the decision is booted back to the Congress. This, of course, has never been invoked, and as you say, could involve some subjective judgment, but it at least is there as a stopgap for a president who, by reason of mental or physical disability, cannot carry out the duties of the office. That's distinct from the impeachment process, which is that the president has abused his powers by committing high crimes and misdemeanors.
Effie, does that answer your question?
It does, to a certain extent. I guess the thing that concerns me is that I see these actions that are being taken that are totally outside of the office of the president, that's being done by the president, and I don't see anyone, at least not officially, you know, saying, okay, this is really not right, or maybe if they do see it, don't go through with it or don't do anything about it.
Yeah, I don't think that's quite right, Effie. In fact, you know, the U.S. House under Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats is doing a lot. It's not just focusing on statutory crimes. It is focusing on what the president is doing beyond what a president should be doing under his oath of office. And while quite properly they're not dealing with the psychological state of mind of the president, they are definitely dealing with his broader actions that potentially violate his oath of office and utilize the powers of the presidency and the U.S. government illicitly. So I don't think you should be too worried.
Effie, thanks. Let's go to Ralph now, joining us from Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Ralph.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if the professor can answer this question, but it's not necessarily easy to phrase. Up until last week, Tuesday, when Pelosi announced an official congressional inquiry for impeachment, subpoenas had been issued and to people, and they might have been stonewalled, meaning Congress and the committee stonewalled, and there is no penalty effect for stonewalling. But now that there's an official inquiry for documents and people to appear before committees, if they don't do those things and do stonewall, can there be any consequences such as jail or fines or whatever that the committees basically have more teeth just because the word official inquiry for impeachment has been announced?
Good question. It certainly does give the committee more teeth when it comes to requesting documents and witnesses and going through the court system. The authority of the U.S. House is at its highest when conducting an impeachment inquiry, and the executive cannot credibly claim that these requests have nothing to do with congressional oversight or political fishing. As far as jail time or other consequences, if someone is held in criminal contempt, they could be prosecuted. But don't count on William Barr's Justice Department to prosecute anyone associated with President Donald Trump. But the House does have an ultimate weapon against presidential stonewalling, and that is to do what they did in the case of Richard Nixon, vote on a separate article of impeachment that has to do with contempt of Congress and violation of the separation of powers. That was one of the three articles that the House Judiciary Committee recommended should be voted against Richard Nixon. That's the ultimate weapon in the hands of the House.
Let's hear a little bit from former Republican Congressman Mike Rogers, who used to chair House Intelligence Committee. He was on CNN about the whistleblower report.
I have to tell you, as a chairman who got whistleblower reports, I would never release the report until it was fully vetted and we had a chance to fully review it and make sure the information was accurate. And then we still might not release the report.
Ellen, how quickly should Americans, the public, expect access to materials related to the impeachment investigation?
I think pretty quickly. You're going to get, obviously, some behind-the-scenes interviews, but behind closed doors, because they might involve classified information. But I suspect the committee will very quickly release at least a redacted version of those transcripts. And so far, nothing that we've seen really involves classified information. The White House put the conversation with Zelensky in this super secret system designed for the most sensitive of classified information, you know, the location of our spies, our sources and methods. But in fact, you know, it was really put there to avoid political embarrassment. There's nothing of high classification in that conversation. So I suspect most of the information that we're going to hear is not going to involve classified stuff. And I think there will be plenty of public hearing. There has to be. If you want to further build public support and have the public understand what's going on, you've got to have public, not behind closed doors, hearings.
But will the whistleblower be protected? You've seen President Trump, who wants to face the whistleblower.
You know, it's outrageous that the president should be attacking and threatening the whistleblower. The whole idea of this process, as you accurately point out, is to protect the whistleblower. But it does seem like this whistleblower is a real patriot, whoever she or he may be, and seems to be willing to take the risk of the wrath of Trump and his supporters in testifying before Congress. We know you know, that Trump has ginned up some very dangerous people who have done some very murderous acts. I'm not saying Trump is responsible, but clearly there are links between Trump's threats and his inflammatory rhetoric and violence.
We're talking with American University history professor Alan Lichtman. He's here as we talk about the impeachment inquiry this hour and the constitutional framework around it. With your thoughts, your questions along the way on how this works, how this inquiry works, you can join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas, WPR.org. Let's go to Mary now in Pewaukee with a question. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Kate. Sounds like your guest is a little bit angry, and I am too. So I join you in that. I think things have gone on way too long. He could have impeachment process could have started earlier for, you know, what I would care to have done. But I'm glad that the process is starting. One question I have is what is your intelligent expert guest think as far as it actually happening, an impeachment or possibly resignation if he knows he's going to be impeached? And secondly, that once this process is started and we get close to the presidency, what happens if Trump is then either elected or what happens during the actual election process once we get to voting?
Great questions, Mary. Impeachment is going to happen, I predict. In fact, I predicted back in September of 2016, even before the election, two things. One, that Trump would be elected, and two, that Trump would be impeached. And of course, everyone scoffed at both of those predictions. Well, the first one obviously came to pass, and I believe the second one is going to come to pass. Why could I possibly predict the impeachment of Donald Trump before he was even elected? Because I had studied his full life and career. And Donald Trump's life was marked by flouting of the law, hiring illegal immigrants, breaking the Cuban embargo, discriminating against minorities in his real estate company. It was marked by inveterate lying. In fact, he got into politics with the biggest, most protracted, worst lie in the history of American politics, that our first African-American president was illegitimate because he was born in Africa. I understood that Donald Trump cared only about himself, had spent his whole life enriching himself and promoting himself, and had performed no public service, the only elected president who performed no public service, either as an elected official, a cabinet official, or someone in the military. And all of these things are now coming to pass in the impeachment process. Nancy?
Short on time here, Alan Lichtman, as we go to a short break here. We'll come back to this in just a moment. Alan Lichtman, a distinguished professor of history at American University. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the process, the history of an impeachment inquiry here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And as we get this context, we should also look at how Americans are feeling at this moment. Polling, of course, underway. New CNN poll shows that 47% of Americans now back impeaching the president. That was up from 41% in May. CBS poll out Sunday showed 55% of Americans now support the impeachment inquiry, and independents are evenly split. So where do you stand on this inquiry? Is this a partisan issue? Is it a political issue? What do you want cleared up? How are you feeling about the direction lawmakers are headed? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Alan Lichtman stays with us through the hour. He's a distinguished professor of history at American University. Alan, as we were talking there to the break, you were exploring as we were going further into what happens in the case of the election season and in the case that President Trump is reelected.
If President Trump, you know, survives the impeachment process, either isn't impeached by the House, and I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think Nancy Pelosi would have made a national television address about impeachment unless she believed it was going to come forth. So if he's impeached by the House but not convicted by the Senate, he's perfectly free to run again and can be reelected. Of course, if he is impeached and removed, that option is taken off of the table. The Senate can preclude him from running again.
The whistleblower report, the Washington Post claims that has almost single-handedly set in motion the gears of impeachment. Is it concerning enough and accurate enough, reliable enough to do that?
Well, let me first explain why the whistleblower report has accomplished what 435 pages or so of the Mueller report didn't accomplish. The Mueller report was prolix. It was unreadable. It was equivocal. It just couldn't inspire passion in anyone. Look at the whistleblower report. It's simple. It's compelling. It's readable. It's short. It tells a narrative. You know, obviously, impeachment is one of the most serious things that the Congress can do. But it's also a matter of persuasion. You have to have a persuasive narrative that, despite all kinds of damning information, if you really delved into it, it is present in the whistleblower report. Plus, unlike the Mueller investigation, we have Trump implicating himself in his own words through the through the reconstruction of his conversation with Zelensky. In addition, you can't have William Barr spinning the whistleblower report because he himself is possibly implicated. So this is fundamentally different as far as whether it's true or not. So far, critical elements have been confirmed. The conversation with Zelensky was accurately described, and the whistleblower accurately pointed out that this conversation and conversations with the Saudi royal family and Vladimir Putin were deep-sixed into the most sensitive classification system. And one of the purposes of the inquiry, of course, is to see whether or not the rest of the whistleblower report is validated. And if so, the president is in very, very deep trouble.
Yesterday, we learned that the president may have behaved with the Australian prime minister in a similar fashion as he did with the Ukrainian president, pressing Prime Minister Scott Morrison to help Attorney General Bill Barr and the Justice Department find ways to undermine the findings of the Mueller report. What do you make of that development?
Well, I think we could be building a conspiracy against the United States, one of the very serious charges against Paul Manafort. The net of those involved in the president's attempts to get foreign leaders to help him politically is broadly expanding. It's Bill Barr. We know traveled to Italy to try to get the Italian government to help with his investigation. This credible reporting that other private attorneys were involved in the effort to pressure the Ukraine. You know, this is more than enough people to charge a conspiracy against the United States, which could be a much more serious charge than anything else that could be leveled against the president. It's one step short of a charge of treason.
Let's go to Mike now, joining us from Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Mike.
Hi. My question is why this is viewed so much as a political party versus party for the impeachment process instead of the actual presidential's ability to hold office, run office, make intelligent decisions, and basically represent the whole country instead of his base.
Mike, you're absolutely right. The very first thing I explained was that impeachment is not some catastrophic process. It's not just partisan revenge. It is one of the two mechanisms, along with elections, for deciding who should hold the most powerful position in the land. And today, the most powerful position in the world. The framers would be taking impeachment even more seriously, you know, if they could have a fast forward time machine and realize we're talking about someone who holds the nuclear codes that could destroy the world. Absolutely, it should not be viewed as a partisan process. But this is Washington. Everything becomes political. But in the end, I'm fully confident the truth will come out. And we may even see, as we did in Watergate, although I'm not certain of that, we may even see once the evidence becomes compelling enough, even Republicans willing to stand up for their country rather than just their party. And it's not even their party. It's this particular president who's actually trashed most of what the Republican Party has stood for over the decades and over 100 years. The Republican Party has always staunchly opposed Russian aggression. Now they're supporting a president who bows down to Russia. Conservatives and the Republican Party has always stood for fiscal responsibility. And we have a president who shattered the deficit. They stood for states' rights. And we have a president who is overriding the ability of California to regulate the environment. The Republican Party has always stood for institutions that stand the test of time. That's the very definition of conservatism. And we have a president who everybody acknowledges is shattering those institutions.
Yeah, Ellen Lichtman, as we're short on time here, whose call is this in the end? Who makes the final decision whether the House votes on articles of impeachment?
The House Judiciary Committee formally does that, but the shots are being called by Nancy Pelosi, as we all know. She's going to have the ultimate say on this. And as I mentioned, she would have not have made an address to the nation on impeachment unless she was going to follow through.
And Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says the Senate would take up impeachment if the House sends it across. Some people don't support impeachment because they don't think the Senate will remove the president. What do you make of that?
We don't know. When all the evidence is on the table, who knows what Republicans in the Senate may do? If they think Donald Trump is threatening their reelection and bringing them down, they may want to remove him. Most of them probably would rather see President Pence anyway than President Trump. Plus, as in the case of Andrew Johnson, the trial itself can moderate the actions of an abusive president.
Well, you, you know, 2 years ago, you came out with your book on impeachment. Why do you think it's taken time? Why is it gaining traction now?
Well, I think it's taken time first because it wasn't going to happen until the Democrats took over the House. There was no way a Republican House was going to investigate this president. Quite the contrary. And, you know, Democrats have always been much more cautious, much more timid, playing not to lose rather than playing to win. That's kind of a hallmark of the party. You know, if Barack Obama had done one-tenth of the things that President Trump is accused of, Republicans would have impeached him faster than you can say Andrew Johnson. But finally, it took a long time. The Democrats do seem to be growing a spine and doing the right thing, which I think anyone objectively looking at it would say, whatever you may finally come down on impeachment, this is certainly worthy of investigation.
We're going to leave it there with Ellen Lichtman. Thank you for joining us.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Ellen Lichtman is a distinguished professor of history at American University. He wrote the 2017 book called The Case for Impeachment, which focused on President Trump. Just ahead, stay with us for On Point. We will continue this conversation on the impeachment inquiry. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.